shul that I'm in, on Rosh Hashanah, there aren't chairs in the aisle. Now, I don't know about your shul, but I would wager that there are many shuls where the fire code rules are not scrupulously observed during the Yom Noraim, and chairs are put in places where the fire marshal has said, this is an aisle, and you may not put chairs. Or the occupancy number for the building is sometimes exceeded, and we turn away. What Rabbi Wozner is telling us is that there are a whole host of things in life that are relatively small issues, and with relatively small issues, we still should encourage people not to violate them, but yet we don't want to encourage people to go around snitching on their neighbors. Because if everybody goes around snitching on their neighbors all the time, nobody wants to be part of our community. Where exactly do you draw the line? That's something we'll come to in just a little bit. The final view is the view of Rabbi Feinstein. Rabbi Feinstein, in essence, says that in order to report a person for a violation of halacha, the punishment meted out by secular society has to be the same as the punishment meted out by halacha. And since in our secular society we incarcerate people for theft, for example, where halacha does not incarcerate people for theft, it's wrong to report people for stealing unless they also engage in violent activity. And Rabbi Feinstein gives us a very classical example to bring the point home. He was dealing with a man in Baltimore who used to go into not kosher factories, produce not kosher food, and put a hechsher on it, which is not a nice thing to do. Not a nice thing to do. He was caught. And they were going to turn him into the police. Maryland has a kosher law, and the kosher law says if you take not kosher products and put a hechsher on it, you will go to jail for 4 to 7 years. Okay? If you do it by accident, it's just a fine. But if you're doing it on purpose, that's a fraud on the consumers, and you will go to jail. This man turned to the Vada Rabbanim of Baltimore and said, I want to go to a Din Torah. I want to go to a Din Torah. How come? He knew for sure that while there were many things the Vada Rabbanim of Baltimore were going to do to him, from publicly humiliate him to make him give away a lot of his money, what was the one thing they couldn't do? They couldn't send him to jail. And so he consented to a Din Torah. The Vada Rabbanim of Baltimore, they wanted to report him to the police. And they wrote to Rabbi Feinstein saying, can we report him to the police? Rabbi Feinstein says, not if they'll agree to go to a Din Torah. And Rabbi Feinstein thus adopts the view, and he's reiterated it in a number of other contexts, that you're not allowed to report a person to the police unless the conduct that they're engaging in is identically punished in Jewish law and in secular law, or the person is engaging in activity that's disruptive of community and won't go to a Din Torah, or the person is otherwise engaging in violent activity such that you can assume they won't go to a Din Torah. But by the norm, he says, it's inappropriate to report a person to the secular authorities in circumstances where secular law overpunishes. Rabbi Feinstein doesn't at all comment on why this is so, nor does he explain to us whether the presence of a democracy or a just government should make any difference. I have to assume that Rabbi Feinstein thought it shouldn't make any difference. But truth be told, I find the position of Rabbi Feinstein very difficult, because the force of Rabbi Wozner's question is very strong. If you're obligated to obey secular law, and the secular government can properly find you and punish you when you violate secular law, then why can't a Jew assist them? And Rabbi Wozner's question seems to me to be very persuasive. It's upon Rabbi Wozner's answer that Jews become prosecutors, or policemen, or tax auditors, or a whole host of other professions that involve hunting down bad people. As Rabbi Schechter of Yeshiva University likes to observe, most of the Rishonim maintain that the phrase "Ubiarta hara mikirbecha," and you should eradicate the evil in your midst, is a mitzvah. and that we do not want to live in a community that tolerates evil people residing in our community. In the best of all worlds, we would have a basin system that functions so that we wouldn't have to reach out of the four walls of halacha to deal with this problem. But we don't. It would be nice if we didn't, but we don't. And we can't even imagine ever being given that authority. In fact, we can't really imagine American law allowing the Beit-Din system to physically incarcerate people, or give dayanim guns, or otherwise give them corporal judicial authority. So we're in a situation where I find it very hard to accept the position Rabbi Feinstein posits. He doesn't rigorously defend it, but he does posit it. But Rabbi Wozner's questions seem strong, and Rabbi Feinstein's responses seem incomplete. The rabbinic phrase is od chazon lemoed. One doesn't know exactly how to handle those circumstances, but Rabbi Wozner's position seems, in fact, very persuasive. So when we step back and summarize, we see a variety of different approaches, and we can draw certain conclusions. When we deal with violations of secular law that are serious and harm people, all halakhic authorities agree that you can inform. So, you know, at some level, when we deal with serious issues, murder, rape, child molestation, armed robbery, arson, serious zoning violations, like builders who pull middle columns out of structures, all of these issues, you can, without a shadow of a doubt, report the person to the secular authorities. This kind of conduct gives rise to both threats to people's lives as well as conduct which endangers the community as a whole. And such people ought to be, as a general matter, reported. So that can be stated first and foremost. So too, when you deal with trivial violations of secular law, even those halakhic authorities who maintain that Jewish law permits informing in those circumstances, I'm not sure it's a wise idea. So when people ask me about informing on their neighbor who is engaging in watering their lawn, when there are lawn watering restrictions, I generally tell them that I don't think I would report my neighbor for watering their lawn at 8:15 when the government says explicitly that lawns may not be watered from 8 to 6. I'm not sure that I want to make these phone calls to the governmental authorities, because there's a certain amount of community building that goes into this, and reporting people for trivial violations is inconsistent with that, even when, in my view, there are ample grounds for saying halakha permits this. Would I report my neighbor for watering his lawn if we were suffering from profound water shortages and people were dying of thirst? You bet. You bet. But when you talk about the regulatory state that we frequently live in, I'm not sure that one invokes the regulatory state all the time and in every circumstance. I would loathe to be part of a community where every time I went speeding, somebody reported me simply because that's the proper thing to do. Then there are middle cases. Middle cases involve hard assessments of the facts. People's conduct is a little bit dangerous. People's conduct is theft of money. In my view, in all of the circumstances where you have a serious violation that affects other people, halakha permits you to inform on a person. So when you're dealing with a person who's not dangerous, he just steals money from people's houses in a non-violent way. So I think Rabbi Feinstein would say you shouldn't report that person, but most contemporary halakhic authorities don't agree with that analysis. And I think would maintain that it's proper and appropriate to report a person who's a regular, ongoing, habitual thief, even if they're not violent in their very nature. The mere act of being a repeated, habitual thief is a sufficient desecration of God's name, as well as, with ample halakhic grounds, a violation of secular law, that we would say it's proper and appropriate to report such a person. Where do we go from here? So it's hard to know. Each case is a little bit different. But the central theme of this lecture can be summarized in three crisp rules. There's a profound obligation to obey the law of the land. If you're not in obedience in the law of the land, your conduct is improper and you should change it. Second of all, when you see people violating the law of the land or hurting other people in serious ways, violations of the law of the land that pose threats to people, it's proper and appropriate to inform on them. Again, I'm not talking about drinking beer from an open container. I'm talking here about serious violations of secular law. Selling subgrade concrete is a serious violation of secular law because it collapses and people die. Selling guns to people who ought not have a gun or who don't have a pistol permit, that's a serious violation of secular law, ought to be reported.
Also drugs too. It would be the same, right?
I'll come to drugs. Somebody raised the question about drugs. Is a very broad term. I'm not sure that when I go to the physician up the block and I say, I've stepped on a nail, and he says, I'll treat you, and here, by the way, is some augmentin. He has now violated the federal drug laws because he did not write a prescription when he gave them to me. Now, that's a drug law violation, but I don't think you can report them. So Hebrew, is much better. Hebrew has two words. It has samanim and trufot. And, Hebrew is wonderful because both mean drugs, but one means drugs. One means drugs. Okay, and if you don't get the difference, you readily get yourself arrested in Israel as you're looking for a pharmacy. You encounter instead a person who's selling, green things in a cigarette, and you end up getting yourself arrested. I don't know. When you talk about serious, hardcore drugs, someone is inclined to think that one reports such a person. The question of what do you do with a cancer patient who's smoking marijuana to control his nausea, I don't think I'd report such a person, even though it does represent a violation of the drug laws. The simple fact is that lots of cancer patients get chemotherapy and they smoke marijuana, and it's just a way to stay alive. And I'm not sure I would report every such case. Certainly if you're dealing and you're dealing serious things, that's a violation and dangerous. So I don't have exact answers, but I turn to you again and say that you ought to be in compliance with secular law. If you're not in compliance with secular law, or if you see people profoundly violating secular law in ways that serious violations, you ought to report them. And of course, the third rule is these rules have an element of common sense. And common sense is so hard to convey to people because those people who don't have it don't get it. And those people who have it, they understand it intuitively. And it's important to understand that not every violation of secular law is a serious one. Not every secular law is meant to be rigorously applied. And people need to develop a certain amount of clear understanding of what makes secular law function. And with that in mind, you readily divide secular law between those laws that are serious and those laws that are less serious in their application. And less serious laws ought not to, by routine, have neighbors informing on each other. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I am glad to answer questions. Sure. Rabbis like answering questions.
And the other thing is, when you were going back to the idea of, let's say, with the forum with the money you owe the non-Jew, even though you're not supposed to tell on him, should you go to the Jew anyways just to say, listen, you should pay up the Jew?
You should always go to a person who you see is doing something wrong. Yeah. If they listen to you and say you should stop what you're doing, it's not proper.
Okay, from what I understand...
I can't hear you, I'm sorry. I think once you deal with money, money is more complicated because small amounts of money are small theft and ought to be reported. There's a difference
between... We'll leave that up for now. But so if you are
It's a sin. It's a sin. Violations of secular law are sinful. Now, we could take this conversation one more nuance and ask, what about secular law which everybody violates and which the police don't enforce? So I'm inclined to think that once you deal with secular laws that everybody violates and nobody enforces, that's not even a sin according to halacha. I can think of such laws in Georgia. We have a thoroughfare going through the middle of Atlanta called 7585. It's an 8-lane highway. That means 8 lanes on this side and 8 lanes on that side, a total of 16 lanes. The speed limit is 55 miles an hour, which is 90 kilometers. It's slow. And people drive down 7585 going 7585. And the police accept this. If they stopped and arrested people for speeding, they would catch us all. So once you deal with secular law that even the police don't enforce, then I think that that's not even a sin. But when you deal with secular law that the police do enforce, okay, but they have to catch you to enforce it, it's a sin to violate those laws. Okay?
Now, if you differentiate the dichotomy between serious infractions and not serious infractions, I picked up there's an infraction of the Spartan law of Sedeta where it relates to light, that's very concrete, that's a serious infraction. But you've kind of skirted really the definition if there are any others, what is serious and what is unserious, which makes me wonder sometimes if we're not dealing with circuitous logic. You know, which is the chicken and which is the egg? Am I not going to report it because it's not important? Or because it's not important, therefore I'm not going to report it? You know, which, did your paper come first? Did the differentiation come first? Or the fact that there's a separation between the two is something that affects on the ground, and we just tend to make those kinds of decisions on our own. So besides, what I'm really asking is, besides the Nishmat Mold Nafshu thing, what else constitutes a real serious infraction that you'd include along the reportable?
So I think the definition of a serious violation of Dina Melchizedina is a violation which the government is routinely makpid on and which normal people take no leniencies with.
Speeding. I
don't know about speeding. In the society that I live in the South, people speed. If nobody sped, I would be very meticulously careful not to speed. Financial fraud, even of a small type, we are careful about. And people who commit small frauds go to jail for small periods of time. And there's no such thing as a small fraud. In my view, the kinds of things that I'm talking about are the kinds of activities that normal people engage in and which the government isn't really careful about. Once normal people don't engage in it and the government is careful and meticulous about it, I would never permit a person to engage in that conduct and I wouldn't protest informing. Where exactly that line is and why am I vague? It's because I'm in Canada and I have no real understanding of the details of the sociology here, and it makes it very complicated for me to give you concrete examples, because the concrete examples that I could give you would be predicated on my life experiences in a similar but different culture. I live in a culture where the gun laws are not scrupulously enforced. Okay? I'm not telling you that that's good, and I'm not telling you that it's proper, but I'm telling you that it's true.
And you ought not to report a person.
So, Georgia has a ready distinction between big guns and small guns, and the big gun laws are not routinely enforced. The small gun laws are routinely enforced. So the answer is yes. I think that distinction has some merit. Would I come to Toronto and say that? I have no idea. So I think that the reason why I'm being vague to you is because I don't know enough about how Dina Melchizedina really works here to even know if people speed. Maybe Canadians really are good citizens. They tell me in Atlanta that you're called our polite neighbors to the north. So,
speed polite.
Okay, I just don't know.
Yes, you touched upon.
I'm sorry. I've suffered from ear infections my whole life, and I've grown deafer and deafer.
The question of what is benefit for the community, all opposed to even greater. Man is informed upon, he's put in prison for 5 years. His family is in a certain state of awareness on the part of the community. It's not
from the Jabbat line, somehow the person gets a note, a letter, they get an email, Big Brother's watching you, and then there's a need for them to somehow verify that they've corrected their wrong. Because once you've made that informant and you sent it off, you sent something that's not for the benefit of the community, and that man may go into depression, he may never work again. But there's a way of nipping it in the bud by confronting the person. I'm not saying directly, who knows, maybe the person will get vicious at you in some way, but by sending them email, by contacting them in some way, letting them know that you are on top of this, without going to the government, you've now saved the family.
I think that that's completely correct. If you can stop a violation through an activity short of Mesira, and you're dealing with a violation that doesn't pose the threat of life to others, I don't think you have to try that when you're dealing with a person who's murdering people, but I think you do have to try that with a person who's stealing money. I would write a letter to such a person first saying, we're watching, be careful. By the way, though, I want to note a famous story. There's a book that just came out, a Sefer, about Tshuvot from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And I asked Rabbi Orbach about a particular Jew who stole a large sum of money, and he was caught by the police in America. This is a quote from this Sefer. He was sentenced to a number of years in prison in America. Was it proper to assist in the collection of money for him? We were speaking about a large sum of $200,000 in order to fulfill the mitzvah of redeeming captives to have him released from prison. When Rabbi Orbach heard this, he stated, redeeming captives? What is the mitzvah here of redeeming captives? The mitzvah of redeeming captives is only when the Gentiles are grabbing Jews irrationally for no proper reason and placing them in prison. According to what I, Rabbi Orbach, know, in America they do not irrationally grab Jews in order to squeeze money from them. The Torah says, do not steal, and he stole money. On the contrary, it is good that he serve a prison sentence so that he learns not to steal.
Just or unjust, if we feel there's some consensus that has to be formed to help to evade this.
I don't think that any particular law is subject to this analysis. I think that you have to ask this question about society as a whole. Governments, like all the rest of us, occasionally make laws that don't accomplish the purpose that they're intended to accomplish. Nonetheless, Din Malchus Adina applies in those circumstances. It's a judgment not about the law, but about the society. So even if you were to believe that the speed limit is too low, and if they raised it 2 kilometers per hour, it would more or better accomplish the goals of government, that wouldn't justify your defying the law. It's not a law-by-law determination. If the government enacts a law for the benefit of the people, even if the law doesn't accomplish its purpose, you're bound by it. It would have to be a patently unjust law.
Would you see in Ontario where the government doesn't pay for Jewish day schools, pays for other religious schools, that would make the government unjust law?
I don't know. The question of how to respond to favoritism of one religion or another is very complicated. You'd really have to be here and know the situation that's running here and where it comes from and where it's going. As a general proposition, government laws that favor one religious faith over another are viewed by Poskim as an indication of an unjust government. Okay, now, how does this apply all the time through and through in a variety of different circumstances? I don't know. When you deal with a government that's generally neutral and has one exception, I don't know. I don't know enough about Canadian law to comment one way or another, other than to tell you that I follow international law enough to know that Canada was cited for United Nations violation because of this, and that there was a big to-do because I think the Canadian government told them to stuff it, and they didn't fix the problem at all.
If you do inform on somebody, is there an obligation to make yourself available to testify in court to make sure that your opinion or whatever is actually based on fact?
Testifying in court against a Jew is permitted in any circumstance where informing is permitted. So I don't see the difference between A and B.
If the rabbis of the community have decided not to inform on somebody because that person would cause a chilul Hashem to the Jewish community, do yet that person is doing something that is dangerous and you know, whatever. So what are you supposed to do in that case?
So this is a very hard question to ask. You have to distinguish between a decision not to report a non-dangerous violation and not to report a dangerous violation. In my view, when you have a person in the community who's engaging in dangerous activity, the fact that reporting him will or won't be a chilul Hashem is of no matter at all. A person who's engaging in activity that's dangerous should be reported by anybody who's aware of the danger. Okay? Now you want to ask a harder question, which is we have, let's say, a Jewish institution that's engaging in zoning violations. Okay, the school is zoned for 357 students, and you know for sure that there are 363 students enrolled, and we've decided not to report it because it's a chilul Hashem and it poses no real safety danger. I would honor that psak. Okay, I think I would honor that psak because you have to have a certain amount of faith in decisions of certain types. There's a difference between a rabbinic decision to let a serial murderer continue hunting us down, because it's a chilul Hashem to report it, which would be preposterous and ridiculous, and I'd be hard-pressed to imagine any rabbinic board could come to that decision, with the decision not to report a zoning violation by a day school. So I think it depends what we're dealing with. You know, Rabbi Moshe Tendler in Muncie had a man in his community come to him 4 days before he married his second wife. His first wife had died. He came to Rabbi Tendler 4 days before his second marriage and said, "Rabbi Tendler, I've overcome it. I killed my first wife, but I've overcome it, and you should know I don't see any danger in marrying my second wife." Okay? And Rabbi Tendler picked up the phone and called the police. I think he's completely correct. Even though there are those who said it brought a terrible chilul Hashem to the community, people who kill their spouses, that's a very serious violation. You know, that's different. And so I need to give you a certain amount of real world, no matter how great the chilul Hashem is associated with having your religious Jew arrested, there's an even greater chilul Hashem associated with allowing our community to become a cesspool for evil people. That's different, though. There's a certain amount of common sense. That's different, though, than small violations of relatively insignificant principles.
We've been speaking about reporting on a fellow Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Does any of this change in terms of reporting on a non-Jew?
Generally, the assumption is that non-Jews are governed by non-Jewish law, and you may conduct your interactions with non-Jews according to non-Jewish law, strict or lenient. Is that a fair answer? I think that when you're dealing with theft from the government, we have to make the following initial assessment. Does the government care? Okay? Does the government care? If we determine that the violation is so rampant that it could only be occurring because the government doesn't care, and this is a fringe benefit it's happy to give out to college students who are going to college in America, sometimes government looks aside because it wants to look aside. Then it's inappropriate to report. Okay, if we decide that government is careful and scrupulous about this activity and it wants to catch all violators and is regularly doing its best to catch violators, then it's an act of theft to engage in this activity. I think that a physician may report such a person. I don't know that I would report such a person, but I wouldn't consider it a form of mesira to do so. I question if it's sufficiently common knowledge that you are prepared to talk about it in public, that the government isn't aware of this and has made the decision not to crack down. This is a very important observation. I don't really know anything about Canadian politics, but if you're aware of the problem That means, and you're prepared to talk about it in public. It means that lots of people are aware of the problem. And if lots of people are aware of the problem and government doesn't do anything about it, that too is telling. I went to NYU Law School a long time ago when I was learning at Yeshiva. And in my naivete, there was a man standing in front of the law school, and he used to say, smoke, smoke. And I was befuddled why he was selling cigarettes. It was befuddling to me. I didn't understand. They sell cigarettes by a pack, and you buy them where the newspapers are sold. So in my naivete, I asked somebody, and they explained to me that he was selling marijuana. That's what he was selling. It was stunning to me, to which I said, well, why doesn't anybody do anything about it? So I marched over to the policeman standing on the corner and said, that man over there is selling marijuana. And he said, well, I'm on duty now, so I can't smoke. Okay? That was one of these incredible lessons to me about American law. My whole understanding of American law grew in a level of sophistication from that nice response from that policeman. Okay, so my comment to you is that while it's important to understand that that policeman gave me a vision of law, that's very important. Not every violation of law. I don't think, by the way, the cop was kidding. Okay, do you understand? He wasn't kidding. He was explaining to me he's not smoking now because he's on duty. Because he thought I was asking him. I mean, we were all operating in different worlds, as you can see. So my comment to you is that you have to really, before you report on somebody for a common violation, you have to make sure that government really cares. Sometimes government just doesn't care. I'm trying to rotate rows, so if I've not answered...
One of the issues that you brought up was community building. What would happen in the situation where someone is doing an incredible wrong according to our sets of rules and standards, but the government of the country doesn't know of such a thing?
Like what?
Well, let's take an example, since we're in Nifty Vote. Someone is pulling students away from Nifty Vote Torah, encouraging them to go into the public school system.
Okay.
What could we do, because we as a community don't have physical power to stop this guy?
So this is not a Masira question. This is a question of how do we exclude people from our community who engage in conduct that we don't like. And the answer is that you have to get up and denounce them, but not be most of them. You have to get up and denounce them. There's certain conduct that if you do in My Young Israel, I ask you to leave. You can ask people to leave the community. We're a voluntary association. And you can ask people to leave when they engage in conduct which is repugnant. You know, they often tell the story about the man who went to the Stifler Gaon and asked about the possibility of taking a concubine. This is a sophisticated, nuanced, halakhic question that I could go into here but won't. And the Stifler Gaon pulled out his cane and hit him on the head with the cane. Okay? It's a very important answer. Certain conduct you don't write tshuvot about. You hit people over the head with a cane. Okay? And when they asked the Stifler Gaon why he hit him with a cane, he said, because I'm 83 and it's too hard to actually hit somebody with my hand. Okay? That's what he said. So I don't have, you know, certain conduct is not covered by this year, but maybe it's just repugnant.
If you know that a fellow Jew providing vital intelligence to a friendly country, are you obligated to inform the police or the FBI or whatever?
These are high-level conflict value questions, so I'll pass. These are very high, these are individualized shilas about Sarfei HaKal. It requires a very intense cheshbon and nefesh, and they're very, very, very fact-dependent and they're very hard to answer. So, there's a level of abstraction in which I could easily say either yes or no. But these kinds of shilas don't come up by routine to any one of us. And I'd rather spend my time talking about tax fraud.
The implication that some things are can be overlooked raises a little bit of a question. There is a question, and there is a story either in the Mishnah or in the Talmud of somebody that was going in the field, and there was a path. And the path became apparent that shortcut. So somebody asked him, how come you're walking in that shortcut? And he answered, as you can see, everybody does that. So the answer that he got is, listening like you are the ones that pave that road, right? So the fact that we're overlooking that makes the law as if that's okay to do.
So this is a very important observation. Government doesn't tell, government sometimes can't control wrongs. Government sometimes overlooks wrongs. When paths are established because of thieves, government tries to stop it, but can't always. Sometimes, though, government enacts policies which it doesn't enforce, because it itself recognizes that the law is silly. So my wife is the United States Department of Labor, labor lawyer. She enforces labor law in the United States. That's what she does for a living. Now, it's a violation of United States labor law to work as a back boy at a baseball game if you're below the age of 16 or the game goes past 10 o'clock. Now, I might have used so many cultural icons in that description that most of you don't get it, but I think there's baseball here as well. Okay, so being a back boy is an honorary activity for a child. Okay, but you're still an employee and you're covered by the insurance policy. Now, the United States government has chosen in its wisdom not to enforce the labor law as it applies to back boys. They don't have any legal right to do that. They do it anyway because they have a recognition that sometimes the law as applied is silly. That's why most states, if you get arrested for marijuana use and you can show that you're on chemotherapy and you have cancer, they dismiss the charges against you, even though over and over again, the Food and Drug Administration of the United States has said you may not use marijuana for medicinal purposes. People live in the real world. So I think there's a difference between paths crafted by thieves and paths that everybody is using that government recognizes. And that's a vision of reality. And you have to be sensitive to that vision of reality. Not every path is crafted by a thief. Take one more question from this side. Actually, person who's subpoenaed should go to court and tell the truth. End of discussion. That's not at all this year at all. This year assumes that you have a choice whether to testify or not. You're subpoenaed. There's never, never a halakhic mandate to lie in a court proceeding other than in very difficult, far-fetched circumstances. You know, you can always create exceptions to these rules. The person is innocent, and your testimony will be misunderstood, and they'll kill you. So yes, maybe then you can lie. But by routine, if you're subpoenaed to testify and your testimony is truthful, you go to court, you tell the truth. Take one last question and then we'll stop.
Yeah, I'm wondering if part of the reason why there are elements in orthodoxy that don't even go to the subpoena seriously and justify to themselves like they're paying all the taxes is because when the reform movement started in the middle of the 1800s, one of the things that they advocated was being good citizens. And, you know, they took that upon themselves, and the neo-Orthodox took that from the reform. Maybe it's a backlash by the Orthodox against that concept. Because the reform were advocating being good citizens, maybe it's a backlash by other orthodox elements
in that they didn't want to be seen as good citizens in order to differentiate from that aspect of reform. I don't think so. I'm not a sociologist of halakha, although, you know, it's enjoyable to think about these things. Essentially, I know nothing about it, but nonetheless, I'll answer your question. My gut is that there are two rationales that push people to cut corners on Din and Al-Husadina. One is that it's fun, and people are tempted to sin in areas that bring them profit. Cheating on taxes is profitable, and thus it's easy to justify. Second of all, the world has dramatically changed in the last 60 years, and we now live in a just government properly done, and many halakhic communities aren't actually rigidly halakhic. They instead follow minhag ha'avos. They follow the traditions and practices of their communities in times of old. And the tradition and practice in Europe with its evil governments was not to obey secular law because government was evil. The best of the governments were evil. Never mind the worst of the governments. And these people have not re-examined the fundamental sources of Dina de Malfusadina in modern times to make sure that their conduct is still consistent with the principles of halakha. Halakha is, in my view, mostly principles to which you apply data, which generates results. You cannot look at the results of a previous generation and follow them, because the data that goes in frequently changes. And thus, 100 years ago, cheating on one's taxes was permitted, and nowadays, cheating on one's taxes is a sin. It's not the result that's... The result has changed, but the principles have remained constant. There are segments of society that are uncomfortable re-examining results because they think that has echoes of conservative or reform. To me, a person who doesn't re-examine the principles, re-examine the results to make sure that the data that's put in is correct, undoubtedly sins. Either they're too strict or frequently they're too lenient. Because as reality changes, halakha has to change its outcome, not its principles, its outcome, to make sure that the principles are being properly applied. Principles never change. Outcome, however, changes depending on the data that goes in. It's for that reason that God tells us men can't wear women's clothes, women can't wear men's clothes, but doesn't give us a list of men's clothes and a list of women's clothes. You want to know what clothes men can't wear? Look at the way women dress. And I'm not either embarrassed or surprised or confused by the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu probably wore a dress, what we would call a dress, because times were different, society was different, and the data that went in was different. So when the data that goes in is different, the outcome looks different. And that's what halakha is all about. It's about keeping the principles fixed and constant, having the data that comes in from society around us change, and whatever results are produced through the principles that God gave us, those are the results that we should live by. Have a good evening, and thank you very much for coming.
Very good. I think what I said earlier, I forgot, is true, and it really was, that by all the questions, I'm sure we could go on a lot longer. It's really a pleasure having Rabbi Broyden, and please God, we'll bring him back again. I want to thank Netivot again, and there are refreshments in the back, and we'll make a Mariv Minyan in 2 minutes for those of us, myself included, who haven't done a Mariv yet. Thank you.
Yes, but see you for very long. Oh.